future church. And what we're going to do over the next 6 weeks is we're going to look at what does it mean to be a church that continually is posturing itself to be one that desires to grow and to last. You know, we're here for a moment. And yet, the reality is that I hope, and I hope you hope the same thing, is that Crow River Church will be a church that is having an impact in Delano and the communities that we represent for 20, 30, 50, 75 years, long after all of us aren't here anymore. And so how do we be a church? How can we become a church and be a church that is sustainable, that grows? And so what we're going to talk about through this series is we talk about what does it mean to be the future church. It's not like a sci-fi series. It's about really what does it mean to be a church that lasts and can continue to have an impact on the lives of the people in our communities. And one of the things that you'll see if you're sort of aware of what's going on in the church world is that a lot of churches that are literally growing older, that aren't having younger people come to them, churches that aren't willing to open their doors to people who are different than them, people who would maybe be considered outsiders, churches that are unwilling to develop young leaders, they are churches that are dying. And yet the churches that are committed to becoming warm places, a warm community that's active in the community, one that is trying to bring God's kingdom into this world, one that is looking at their younger people and saying, these are the next generation of leaders in our church, and I'm willing to invest, I'm willing to mentor them. Churches that are willing to adapt to the changes in our world. Those are the churches that are going to continue to grow and the churches that are going to continue to live. And so there's going to be weeks in this series that we're going to talk about younger people. But this is a series that's bigger than just investing in younger people. It's a series looking at how do we be a multi-generational church. One where people of all age groups feel like there's meaning and purpose here. But how can we be a church where people who come for the first time, and some of you are here for the very first time, did you feel like this is a warm and inviting place? How about people who look different than us? People who might even have questions that we're not comfortable asking. Even people who might believe things that are different than us. Are we a place where they can come in and feel at least welcomed? A place where they can come explore faith in Jesus and be surrounded by people who aren't going to judge them but encourage them? So that is sort of an intro to this series. And this morning I'm really excited because Jason, who, like I mentioned, is a pastor at Bethel, has done a lot of work on faith development. And in the program, it says, I think, empathizing with young people. It's probably not the best title. But what we're going to talk about this morning, I'll let Jason sort of get into this, is different stages of faith development. And so how do we, as parents, as teachers, as leaders, as mentors, how can we develop in our faith, but also how can we help our kids and the students in our church and the young adults continue to develop in their faith? And in the end, what you can boil that all down to, and it's one of our values, is how do we make disciples? The great commandment that Jesus gave us, make disciples of all people. How are we as a church going to make disciples? So with that, I'm going to hand it over to Jason, and we're going to sort of do some back and forth. And so let's welcome Dr. Jason Steffenhagen.
Hi.
He really is a doctor now. And he was in that movie 300, if you look for him.
One of the people with a toga on. What can I say? Anyway. I'm so glad six packs aren't required. So my story, some of you know me a little bit better than others. Some of you have heard me talk a little bit about my journey as I've been here a few times. So I graduated from Bethel. My wife and I moved down to Tennessee for 10 years. And when we got down there, I didn't have a job, fumbled around for a little bit, and then kind of wrote my own job description at the university we were working at. or my wife was working at, I wrote a job description to be their discipleship coordinator, to oversee a new discipleship program that they were starting to establish. And that was a really fun experience for me because I had had some discipleship work when I was an undergrad. I helped lead some small groups and Bible studies. And so I got to lead this program, but I quickly realized a few years into it that I really had no idea what I was doing other than saying, like, hey, go talk about Jesus. That was about the extent of instruction that I gave my leaders. And so I was challenged in a really healthy way by a mentor of mine and one of the vice presidents who worked at the university to really dive into how do people grow? Like, how do they grow? How do they grow in their identity? How do they grow in their faith? How do they grow cognitively, the way they think? How do they grow morally? How do they grow behaviorally? All these different ways in which we grow. Now, some of that we just naturally do. Like, we learn moral development because, you know, we recognize that just following the rules isn't always enough. Sometimes rules need to be broken because there's a greater good at stake. Like, we all know that stealing is wrong, but if your family is starving, like, you might argue that it's justifiable, right? Like, now some of us would be like, well, no, your family probably hasn't starved, right? So, like, we can bend things a little bit. We can grow morally to understand situations. It's the same thing with our faith, same thing with our identity. Like, at one point, we had a really firm sense of who we were, and then we had some new experiences, and suddenly we started going, I don't know who I am anymore. I don't know my place in the world. I don't know what I'm called to. I don't know what I'm supposed to do with my life. I got to figure out who I am again, right? And some of us experience that maybe when we go to college. Some of us experience that when we have kids or our kids start getting a little bit older. And now it's like, hey, we've been married for 20 years. Our kids are, you know, going off into high school and we suddenly have free time. What does this relationship look like between the two of us now, right? And so you have to kind of grow and develop and to figure out who you are. And so the faith is the same way. Faith is something that develops and grows. And the fun part about, I think, what we're going to talk about today is that this isn't just about how do we help young people, but this is for all of us. And so I want to unpack faith development, and I'm going to interview Aaron. So this is part sermon, part like college lecture, part interview. And we're going to kind of walk through what does faith development look like for us, or generally, and how can it apply specifically to us, and then how can we use that to help young people? Because as Aaron said, if we're going to be a growing church, if the church in America is going to grow, we're going to have to embrace the way young people are thinking and interacting with their faith. And if we, you know, and correct me if I'm wrong, but how many of us had a moment when we thought of the way our parents did things and said, nah, I'm not doing it that way. And then the parents were like, oh, yes, you are. Like, this is how we do it around here, right? And then we're like, no, that's not how we do it. And then suddenly, we're doing church in an auditorium, right? Like, and as opposed to someplace else, as opposed to a cathedral, right? And so there's new iterations of church. There's new ways of going about things because new generations want an interaction that is connected to who they are and the way that they see community being formed, the questions they're asking, the way that they're wrestling with Scripture. And so it's natural for this to keep growing and to keep moving. It's going to make us uncomfortable, and that's okay. I want to stop for a moment and say, being uncomfortable is okay. And as we go through this, you might find yourself being uncomfortable. As you go through this, you may think, I'm not going to be comfortable if my kid starts doing this. I'm not either. I'm a parent. But this is a part of the developmental process. And so we're going to dive into this. The first thing I want to point out, though, is that I think there's some really healthy scriptural foundation for this. This isn't just a theory Sunday, okay? We're not just going to avoid the Bible and just talk about human development theory. We're going to talk about faith development theory and base it on Scripture. And so there's a few scriptures that I want to bring up that I think are truly foundational for what we're getting after. The first one is Deuteronomy 6:5. This is part of the Shema. This is part of the kind of the foundational mantra of Israel. Like when they ask Jesus, what is the first commandment? He doesn't quote a single Ten Commandment, not a one of them. He goes here to the Shema, Deuteronomy 6:5. And it says this, love the Lord your God with all of your heart and with all of your soul and with all of your strength. Now, some of us that are familiar with the New Testament, like Mark 12:30, would go, hey, Jesus, like the Old Testament left one out. Why is that? Because Mark 30 says, love the Lord your God with all of your heart and with all of your soul and with all of your mind and with all of your strength. Seems like maybe Jesus or the New Testament authors added something. So let's go back to the Deuteronomy passage for one second. We can see it up on the screen. There is no mind there. Why is that? Well, there's actually a really simple explanation for that. The Hebrew language is only about 4,000 to 5,000 words long. Which you're thinking like, wow, 5,000 words, that's quite a bit. The English language has over 40,000, and they keep adding words every single year, like ginormous, which is really ridiculous. We could just say gigantic or enormous, but instead we say ginormous, which should just be like whatever, but instead we add it to the dictionary. Okay, so now it's like 45,000 words long instead of 40,000 words long. So if you have a language that's 4,000 words long and a language that's 45,000 words long, if there's 45,000 words, that means that these 4,000 words are going to have some significance to them because they're going to have to say a lot of different things. So for instance, the word heart in the Hebrew language means more than just a beating heart. Okay, we know that in English, right? If I were to say like, oh, you know, I just have a heart for that. Like, that doesn't mean that I have a beating muscle in my body that is like attracted to something. No, it means that I have emotion, I have passion, I have feelings towards something. So if I have a heart for Aaron's well-being, it means I have feelings and passions and energy towards Aaron's well-being. Okay, so even in our language, heart carries more than one meaning, right? But in the Hebrew language, the word heart, it kind of was the will, the intellect, the emotions. It was the brain and the heart of a person. And so when the Old Testament author here, when Moses writes that we need to love God with all of our heart, you could almost say heart-mind, or you could say emotions and intellect, or you could say feelings and will. So it's a both and so it was incorporated into the meaning of the text. So all the way back in Deuteronomy, we have this picture of loving God with all of our heart, our heart-mind, if you will, all of our soul, and all of our strength. And in essence, what the author there is saying is basically everything that you are should be loving God. All of you. There's not a piece of you that gets left out of the mix. Okay, love is a complicated word. Love is not something that we can scientifically articulate. Okay, we can kind of articulate it based on the evidence that we see. Like, if I punch Aaron, that's not a sign of love. So we might say that love is not here. But if there's a bug on his face and I slap him, you may all think I'm being mean, but I may be saving his life from malaria, right? So love can take on different expressions depending on the circumstance. Ultimately, what love is a big-time mystery, right? It's the mystery of the universe. What is love? And ultimately, love is relational. I can't love nothing. I have to love something. So love is based on a relationship. And I've given that talk before here, so I don't need to go too deeply into it. But we all know that if love is relational, and relationships take two to tango, or communities to do this, we know that we don't get to stop them, right? I don't ever accomplish friendship. Right, Aaron and I have been friends. We're both, he's about to turn 36. I just turned 36. I'm a month older than him. And we've been friends since we were about 2 years old. So it's like a 34-year-long friendship. We haven't finished it. We haven't accomplished this friendship. This is a never-ending thing, or it's a non-existing thing, right? Like, it's either we are friends, and we're actively involved in growing and moving and building one another and encouraging one another, or we're just not, and we're not friends. And so relationships and love are ongoing, and they don't get to stop. God doesn't ever express himself in the Bible as saying, I'm going to finish loving you. No. Like, God doesn't finish loving us, and he doesn't say to us, hey, you're going to get to a certain point, probably when you're about 63, where you're going to be done loving me. And at that point, you can love something else for a while. No, of course not. God's a jealous God. God knows that to be in full relationship means that we are constantly moving towards God at all times. And so love is developmental. Love is moving. Love is growing. Okay, the second verse that I want to bring up, or the third one, is Romans 12:2. And really quickly, do not conform to the pattern of this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. Then you will be able to test and approve God's will is, his good, pleasing, and perfect will. And really quickly, because we need to jump into the faith development stuff, being transformed by the renewing of your mind, most scholars would say that this is a both-and situation. It's the Holy Spirit transforming us, and it's our involvement in the transformation. We have to be an active participant. We don't say a prayer, go to an altar, or have someone lay hands on us, and suddenly our mind is completely changed. I mean, when you became a Christian or a Christ follower, when you prayed a prayer, you didn't suddenly have no sin, no temptation, nothing wrong with you. Like, you're here. Clearly you know something's wrong, or else you wouldn't want to be a part of a community that's trying to transform the world, right? And so there is something ongoing about that, and you have to be an active participant. So faith development is both the Holy Spirit doing something in us, God doing something to us, and us being an active participant in that process. One principal foundational thing I want to make sure that we hit on before we dive into this. We're going to value relationship over rightness. That's what we're moving to. We're moving towards what does it mean to be in relationship, not just being right all the time. Okay, we've talked about that before. I'm not going to beat that over the head, but I just want to make sure that we mention that. Okay, stage one. Okay, now we're going to start flying through these stages. Stage one is the intuitive projective phase. It's when you're like 2 to 6 years old. It's this imaginative stage. Fantasy and reality are both trusted. So, like, Santa Claus is so real, he brings presents. The tooth fairy, like, literally puts money under your pillow and takes your tooth away to a magical place that has a whole bunch of other people's teeth. And your parents are amazing, your grandparents are awesome, and so is Jesus, so is God, so is walking on water, so is Daniel in the lion's den. All of it makes sense, all of it's real. Like, superheroes exist. Like, Dad, are you stronger than Thor, or is Thor stronger than you, right? Like, those are the questions that we get. Okay, that's 2 to 6 years old. And so the key concept here, or the spiritual component here, is that our first impression of God is established at this point. Our first concept, our first impression of God is established when we're very young. And this can actually be a very hard thing to move on from. When we picture God, we have a certain image in our mind. It's probably from when we were 2 to 6. So the question I have for Aaron is, how did you conceive or envision God when you were growing up?
You ever seen The Wizard of Oz?
Of course.
We may have watched it together.
Probably.
Probably. So for me, conceptually, the way that I, growing up, how I can remember visualizing God was similar to Oz. Like, heaven was sort of the land of Oz, this mystical place that you couldn't, like, hop on a train or a bus or a plane to get to. But it existed, and it was mysterious, and you somehow got there. And then the idea of God and his throne room was similar to Oz's throne room. And I imagined that the fire, the head floating, and like that was God. Like this mystical, powerful force that existed somewhere else in heaven, in the land of Oz. And I think in some ways there was some good that came out of like that visualization, in that it helped me recognize that like God is on a different playing field than I am.
Yep.
Like he's holy, I'm not. And so I think there was like the reverence piece of revering God. And how the Bible talks about that is like fearing God, which sounds kind of weird, but it's not like you're scared of him, but you recognize that he's holy and I'm not. So I think that was planted early on. Just how I would think about God was similar. But I think what I've had a hard time, and I've still struggled with this, because I think still to this day, if I think about the throne room, I think about God and where he actually like is, I'm sending prayers. Like he's somewhere else, this mystical place, and I'm here. And so if I'm praying or I'm doing things, I hope he can recognize me, like pay attention to me. And I think where that has hurt me is when you look at what Jesus taught, and even when it talks about Jesus in New Testament writings, it says, look, we don't have a God who can't empathize with us, who is unable to empathize with our weaknesses. See, the God who lives in Oz is hard to relate to, but God, through Jesus, wants us to be able to relate to him. And Jesus' teachings, which really started to transform how I viewed God as I started to really dig into it as an adult, was his talk of the kingdom coming here. Mm-hmm. That, like, earth isn't this bad place that we're trying to escape to and get into Oz, but that Jesus has come and he's saying, look, I am making all things new. I'm renewing the earth. I'm coming in and I'm calling you to be a part of bringing my kingdom into this broken place. And so recognizing that like God's presence, even Mel prayed it, like God's presence is here. Mm-hmm. It's still sometimes hard for me to go, it's here or it's up there. Mm-hmm. So as a kid, it was always God is there, I'm here.
Yeah.
And I don't know if I can really relate to this big mystical being.
Sure. I think that's really beautiful because there is, like you said, reverence and fear and awe is like a necessary component of our relating to God. But there's other connotations that come with that. I mean, the wizard demands things of them in order to do something for them, right? Well, that's not grace at all. Grace doesn't say you have to do anything. It's while you were yet sinners, Christ died for you. While you're imperfect, while you haven't done anything, there's grace. As opposed to go kill the wicked witch and then I'll give you your, you know, your stuff, your heart and your mind and whatever else, your courage. And then secondly, so I think we often do that, right? As kids, we like maybe it's Zeus with fire bolts, right? That's how we picture God. Or it's like a vending machine, like God gives us stuff. If we just make, you know, do the right things, if we say the right things, if we pray enough times, if we go to enough church services, like we'll get more. And that's those are just hard conceptions of God to get rid of, but they're easily for us to attach ourselves to. Not to take the Wizard of Oz analogy any further, but it's really fascinating because what does Dorothy ultimately want? She wants to go home. She wants heaven to come to earth, right? Like at some level, she wants to go home and let that be the magical place that it should be. We should do a whole sermon on the Wizard of Oz. It'd be really fun. Anyway, okay. Stage two. This is from like 6 to 12 years old. The key concept here is that as we understand concrete operational thought, that what we can see, touch, hear, smell is real, is with us, then we have to start explaining everything, right? And so a 6 to 12 year old is going to ask a lot of why questions, and they're going to literally explain everything away. Okay, my favorite example of this with my son at times is like Daniel in the lion's den, and it's like the lions didn't eat Daniel, and like an angel showed up, and he's like, angel showed up, the lions didn't eat the guy, are you serious, Dad? And then I'm like, yeah, that's what happened. And he goes, I got it. There was an angel, there were three lions. The angel sat on one lion and then has really strong arms and held the mouths of the other ones shut so they wouldn't eat Daniel, right? He can't just like go with a miracle, right? Because miracles are like what we understand is just like God doing something crazy cool that's beyond our understanding. For him, no, there's got to be a rational explanation for this. And if there isn't, I can't believe in it because he doesn't believe in Santa Claus anymore. Sorry, kids. He doesn't believe in the tooth fairy anymore, right? Like he gets that can't happen, right? There's no chimney in our house, right? Like, so he's starting to wonder that about God. And so the question that it brings up for us and God or the spiritual component is we start to wonder if the Bible story is actually true. And we start to find reasons to trust in it. We start to logically think through it. And that's okay. Like, we got to give kids the willingness to do that. Instead of going like, Maddie, come on. There wasn't an angel that sat on a lion. Like, that's just not how it was. Like, no, he's trying to get it. Like, let him try. Like, he's seven. Like, it's okay. He's trying to get into this story and believe it. And that's the point. I want him to be engaged with this, not just get it right. Which we're going to see is more about getting right as opposed to being in relationship, right? So don't worry so much about getting it right. Worry about, is he engaged in this story? So the question I have for Aaron is, what was your favorite Bible study growing up, and maybe which character did you want to be like?
Joseph was which favorite.
Old Testament, New Testament?
Old Testament. Okay. So I still remember the flannel board. So I grew up in the church, and if you were a part of it, back in the 80s and 90s, the flannel board teaching where they would put up the, you know, the blue flannel board. And I just remember I liked Joseph because he looked the coolest because he had the multicolored coat. And I think his story was like the reason I think liked it the most as a kid. And actually, it's still one of my favorite stories of the Bible. Is the good, he kind of wins. Like, the good guy wins. Mm-hmm. The good guy triumphs mm-hmm. over the wrong that has been done to him. Yeah. You know, so he goes from being abandoned by his brothers, he keeps doing the right thing throughout his life, and yet getting the short end of the stick, and yet God is continually faithful to Joseph as he's faithful, and then he ends up in this position where there's then this beautiful reconciliation between his family,
yep.
But I think I viewed it as, here's a good guy, he wins.
Yeah. It's fascinating, because what Aaron just did there is he answered the question, but he also did the adult thing, where, like, he liked him because he had cool clothes on, which is, like, a total six-year-old thing to say, right? Like, well, that one's dressed the best. Like, I'm going to go with that. And he wins, right? Like, kids like a winner. And now he's, like, applying it totally differently, right? Like, hardship isn't the end of the world, God will see us through to the end. Now, a seven-year-old probably isn't going to, like, totally get that part of it, but that's the maturity of a person who's gone through a faith journey. But there's an attractiveness to the story that we latch ourselves onto, and hopefully as that gets kind of said, hey, yes, stay with it, we can move to a point of recognizing the true power of that story. wasn't just that he had a cool coat on. It wasn't just that he won, but it's that God was going to see him through and use him despite the horrible things that happened to him.
I think, too, at this age, when you're getting the Bible stories, you believe that all of these characters are good, like almost superhero type people. And like the biblical heroes of our faith, especially in the Old Testament. And yet as an adult, as you get older, you realize these are pretty rotten people in some ways. You know, Moses is a murderer. David is an adulterer.
And a murderer.
You know, Jacob is a thief and a manipulator. I mean, you start to really dig in. Noah's a drunk. You know, like, you dig into these stories.
Samson,
like,
we won't even go there.
Yeah, I mean, it's just like, oh, wow, like, they're not the greatest people.
Right.
And what's cool about that is you recognize God uses torn up, weak, sinful people to do amazing things. But the thing I love about Joseph, even to this day, is we don't get a window into like, his sin life. I mean, he wasn't perfect, but, man, he was a man of integrity.
Yeah.
And I think still as an adult, as I look at that story, I want to be like Joseph because of his integrity.
Yeah. No, totally. That's beautiful. Okay, third stage. Once we kind of get over the fact that we can't know everything, because eventually we're, like, 12 years old, we go, man, I can't solve all of this. I realize that. Like, I don't get this whole Bible thing. So what we do is we look around and we go, who can I trust that seems to know more than I do? And so that's when we really lean on parents, grandparents, aunts and uncles, youth pastors, teachers. We look to the church, like so institutions we look to. We look to the church. We look to our schools. If we don't have solid places like that, we may look to pop culture, LeBron James. We may look to people like that in media, in society. We may look to politicians. We look to anybody who seems to have it all together that's supplying us with answers to the big question. And the big questions are, who am I, how did I get here, and what am I supposed to do now that I'm here? Okay, and like that's what churches are answering, that's what parents are trying to help kids understand, and that's what ultimately we need to figure out is, who am I, how did I get here, and what's it all for? And so those are some of the ideas or the components of this third stage, but we do that by looking to other people and other things. It's not something that we just inherently like have the ability to think about. Instead, we look outside of us. So it's called an externally driven faith. So it's external to us. So the question I have for Aaron, and the question that you guys can all ponder too, is who are the people that most profoundly impacted your faith, and maybe even what was a book that maybe kind of helped provide a clear foundation for you?
Yeah, I think the people through high school and college, and then when I would say I really became a Christian in my 20s, was my parents were profound in regards to my faith and my faith development.
That was a good one, because they're actually here, yeah. So yeah, good job.
I have a mentor who I met when I was like 13 years old, who I still meet with to this day, Lowell Seashore, who has had one of the biggest impacts on my faith. And then I would say a pastor and author, Tim Keller, just as mm-hmm. I became like got mm-hmm. older, just his writings and his preaching mm-hmm. has really helped shape my thinking and faith. But a book that I remember reading when I got out of college and I was trying to decide, like, am I a Christian or am I not, was Irresistible Revolution by Shane Claiborne.
Yeah.
And I remember it had such a profound impact on me because I think at that, what Christianity was for me growing up was like get out of hell card. Mm-hmm. And it was like, if I'm a Christian, I don't go to hell. I don't want to go to hell. So that's great. And when I die, I'll go to heaven.
Right.
So, you know, ask Jesus in my heart and I'm good.
Yep.
When I read Irresistible Revolution, it was a book, for the first time I was hearing somebody not like say, look, when Jesus taught this stuff and to live this way, it was actually live it now. Mm-hmm. And Claiborne was doing like these amazing, like he was living out what the words of Jesus. And it was the first time I read someone who was challenging people to actually live out the way of Jesus.
Yeah.
And that started to shape.
Yep.
Like, this is what it means to be a Christian.
Yep.
It's now.
Yep.
It's not when I die and then I go to heaven. Like, there is work to do now.
Mm-hmm.
And do I believe in the words of Jesus and the life of Jesus and the way?
Yep.
And am I willing to commit my life to it? I was incredibly challenged.
Yeah, no, that's beautiful. I think for many of us, we're going to have those people or those books that seem to kind of just nail, you know, the essence of who we are. And they, the beautiful part about stage three, and a lot of people stay in stage three. I'm just going to be really honest. Like, many adults stay in stage three. And the reason is because they figure out how to answer the big questions in life. And then they go, I'm good. I'm gonna trust this. I'm going to stay here. And that's okay. Because if your life looks like the fruit of the Spirit, love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control, great. Like, if that's what your life looks like and your foundation and your faith is propelling you to that, awesome. Like, no one's going to argue with you. Like, no, like Jesus isn't going to go, well, you didn't intellectually answer this question. I mean, like, I think ultimately Jesus is going to go, did you love others, right? Like, did you treat people with kindness? Like, were you a person of self-control, or did you just want whatever you wanted all the time, no matter how much it costs other people, right? So if your faith is leading you to a place of benevolence and kindness and justice and love, like, then that's a beautiful foundation, and live into that. But if you notice that you're defending your foundation more than you're defending love, if you're defending, say, Calvinism or Arminianism more than you're defending justice or kindness, then we might need to do a little bit of work. And that's where the stage transition comes in. This usually happens sometime in your 20s, 30s, maybe even a little bit older. But the idea is that we are introduced to some tensions, some pain, some crisis in our life. And so what we have to understand is that we're going to ask questions. We're going to doubt things. We're gonna wonder. We're going to speculate. We're going to try new things on. Like Aaron said, in his 20s, he was wrestling with, am I really going to trust this faith that I was handed to, this pray the prayer kind of faith? Or is there something more to it than that? Okay? Now, some people in the church would say that kind of doubt, that kind of questioning, that kind of wrestling is like absent of faith. But that's a faith of certainty or being right. But if it's a faith of relationship, of course he's going to question it. Of course he's going to have his doubts and his curiosities. Of course he's going to have a moment of crisis. Like we all do in all relationships. I mean, I've been married now for 13 years. I have definitely woken up some days and said, what the heck are we doing? Right? And then, like, we figure it out. We talk it out. We fight it out. We argue it out. And then we recognize that in the fight is where we're loving each other. In the questions and the doubts is where love actually is truly birthed. It's not just in the mountaintop moments. Those are fun too. But it's in the mess of it all, in the brokenness of it all, that we can truly dive into love. And so that's this tension. That's the doubt. That's the question, is we need to dive into that. So you mentioned Shane Claiborne in that book. Who else was it maybe that helped you start asking those questions? Or what circumstances maybe led you to see the world a little differently?
Well, seminary, you were sort of forced to start to think differently, when, you know, writing papers, and they teach you how to think, and I think that had a big impact on me. This might sound a little strange, but seeing friends walk away from the faith helped ask a lot of those big questions.
Yeah. Yep.
Like, why do I believe this? Why? How do I wrestle with doubt? All those things, and seeing the reasons why some of my friends weren't Christians, I think forced me to think about why am I going to be a Christian? And then I would say seeing other parts of the world.
Yep.
I went on my first mission trips to the Dominican Republic, and that had a profound impact on me. Just seeing a different culture and seeing how they worship and seeing their faith. Went to China, and I'll never forget this conversation. Me and a buddy met these two girls who kind of showed us around Beijing. And at one point, these girls said to us, they go, your parents must be really proud of you. And I was like, well, yeah, I mean, I think they are. They go, and I was like, why? They go, because you're a boy. And I remember feeling so sad. And I said, well, aren't your parents proud of you? And she said, no, I'm a girl. And I remember feeling just so sad that was her identity. These girls' identity had been shaped by, you know, the fact that they weren't a boy. And that, you know, there are other places in the world that are very different than my safe place back home. And then I would say going to Haiti and seeing real poverty. Mm-hmm. Which is why I think if you can go on a short-term missions trip ever, I don't think short-term mission trips, like, we don't go there and save people and fix problems. I just don't think that's going to accomplish it. But I think if we go on them, what it ends up doing is helping shape our view of the world and helps us see that it's a lot bigger than our reality here.
Yeah. No, that's really, I mean, so according to faith development theory, there's kind of two different things in my research that I've found. It's circumstances in our life, actual pain. Like when I interviewed college students for my dissertation, it was people that lost a loved one to like an overdose or to a tragic circumstance in their life at a young age, parents that got divorced, churches that rejected missionary kids when they got back to that, to like their home base. And so it was significant circumstantial things that happened to them that forced big questions into their life. Or it was a different external person. So parents growing up, youth pastor, kids back home, and then you go to college and, you know, pastor at college, favorite professor, college roommates have a totally different life experience, and they start influencing you, and now you're caught in this middle space, and you're like, ah, like, I don't know who I am anymore. I don't know what I think because I trust my parents, but I also trust this professor, and they're saying different things, and they have different views on the Bible. They think different authors wrote it. Now I'm just really confused, and now I'm stuck in this in-between place. The danger of stage three is that when we're faced with difference, we just retreat. We just go back to what's comfortable. We go back to what's safe. We go back to all the answers that we know. I'm not saying those answers are wrong, but the key to stage three and the transition of it is that we actually engage it, that we don't ignore the questions, ignore the doubt. So when Aaron goes to Haiti or Aaron was in China, when those girls said, your parents must be proud of you, and they said, why? Because you're a boy. Aaron didn't just go, oh, sucks for you. I probably shouldn't say that in church, but he didn't just say that. He let that hit him. He let that sink into his being and to go, why is there a world where women are born and don't have a sense of identity or pride about themselves? When I go to Haiti and I see all this poverty around me, how are we creating a world where we're exploiting people this much, where a nation can be so wealthy and a nation can be so poor and be like 600 miles apart from each other? Like, how is that humanly possible? Now, we could ignore that and just be like, well, they probably made some poor choices and our founding fathers made really good ones. And so, therefore, this is why it's justifiable that we live this way. Yeah, you could do that. You could explain it away and then never think about it again. That would be retreating. Instead, or you could just let it hit you. Sit with it for a moment. And then here's the next thing. And this is stage four, is we figure out what's our voice. We figure out, what is it that I think about this? What am I going to take ownership of? What am I going to run with? What am I going to sink my teeth into and process and own and take the next steps in and let that shape me? So we start not just saying, who else around us has answers to the big questions about who I am, why am I here, how did I get here, what should I do? But I'm asking that question. What do I think? Who am I? How did I get here? What does God have to say about that now? And what is God calling me to do? Not just what do my parents want me to do, not just what does the church want me to do, not just what does this mysterious, you know, Wizard of Oz, Jesus want me to do, but what is it based on my work with the Spirit being transformed, right? Taking on the mind of Christ, what is it that I, why am I here and what am I going to do with this one wild and crazy life that God has given me? And so stage four is a place of ownership, but there's a danger to stage four. And we're just going to fly through this because we got to get to our last song. The danger of stage four is that when we start to figure out our own voice and we start to take ownership of our own lives, we can start to think that we've figured it out and that we now have the secret sauce to life. Like, I know it because I've thought through it. And what happens is that most of us that are in a stage four, and this is me a lot of the time, is that when we're in stage four, we can start to put our way on everyone else. So, oh, you're in that question. I've been through that question. Now let me tell you how I got through it because you should do the exact same thing I did. Now that's just me becoming an external influence on that person. That's just me telling them what to think. When that's not what got me to my place. What got me to my place is somebody coming alongside me and saying, hey, what do you think about that? What in your experience resonates with this question? How are you thinking through this? Right? I was allowed to go on a journey. I was allowed to think for myself. And so I need to now become a person who helps others do that. Not a person who says, I've figured it out, but a person who said, hey, I'm on a journey and I want to help you in yours. And so what I want us to do is we're going to jump forward in the slides a little bit. I want us to just to point out a few quick questions or ideas that you guys can take with you in your own journey and then as you are helping the young people in our church and in your community. So What does this all mean for us? First, this is what Aaron just got done talking about. Difference needs to be desired. We have to expose ourselves to new things. We have to. We cannot grow if we don't come across something new. Something has to challenge us, has to push us. Doubts, questions, crisis, pain are part of the journey. They're not the antithesis of the journey. They are part of it. We need to like settle into some of those things sometimes. Quick answers and solutions don't always help. When we're in the midst of a journey and we're in the midst of crisis, or if somebody you love is in the midst of a crisis, it isn't just solve it for them, make it go away. Sometimes it's, hey, I can see that's hard for you right now. Tell me about it. I can see that you're struggling. Tell me why is that hard for you? What are you wrestling with? What questions are you asking? Let me sit in that with you for a moment. Fourth, process-oriented relationships are essential. We need people in our lives who can do just that, that can sit with us and listen. When students come to my office and they have a faith crisis, my first response to them isn't, oh, here, let me tell you about it. My first question to them is, well, what do you think? Like, I don't know if, you know, Jesus is real. Well, tell me why you're asking that question. Tell me why you're wrestling that. What led you to that? What circumstance brought you to that? Not, well, let me give you all the apologetic reasons why Jesus is actually real. No, like, they don't need another answer. They need someone to sit with them in that moment of crisis. And we can be people for others like that. Fifth, we need to keep growing and questioning and thinking. This is relationship, not rightness. We have to keep growing and questioning and thinking. Okay, now what does it mean for our youth? They need to establish a foundation. They need to be in Sunday school. They need to hear the stories. They need to fall in love with Joseph. They need to fall in love with Deborah. They need to fall in love with Mary. They need to fall in love with Jesus. They need to embrace this story and to try to figure it out in their own weird, convoluted way. Okay, like let them be seven and like mess it up. Like they just need to figure this out any way they can. Secondly, it's normal for them to end up questioning it. At one point, they're going to go, wait, how did a kangaroo get from the Middle East to Australia if the flood only happened 4,000 years ago and the earth was the way it was? Right? They're going to question it. And you're probably not going to have an answer to that because there isn't one, right? Like, I don't know, Noah made a raft and pushed him a long way? I'm not sure. Like they're going to have questions. Those don't need to be scary. Just go, wow, what do you think? Or why are you asking that question? Or, hey, let's find somebody who we know that might have a response to that. We can get coffee with the pastor if we use the new app, right? Okay, third thing, relationship over rightness. With your kids, practice love, not perfection. You're going to be a failed parent. Love them through it. They're going to fail you. Love them through it. Like, be in relationship. Honor that relationship and hold that relationship so much more sacred than having to be right all the time. Your kids are going to follow your modeling. If you model love and you model the journey, if you model the process, they're going to be okay going on one, as opposed to feeling stuck and trapped because they're not perfect and because you're presenting perfection all the time. Like, allow there to be a journey in your parenting. Allow there to be a journey in your child. Fourth, don't always answer their question. Sometimes they need to sit in the disequilibrium. Sometimes they need to embrace the crisis. So it's okay for them to have a question, and it's okay for you to say, well, that's a good question. What do you think? Or, that's a great question. Why are you asking it? And if they go, I don't know, then you can say, well, when you know why you're asking it, then we can talk. Until then, I'm not just going to answer that for you because you're a smart, growing individual who has a brain. So let's talk when you're ready to talk. Fifth, ask them more questions. Like, when you read scripture together, say, what stood out to you about that? What made you come alive? What aha moment did you have in listening to that? Like, we have to ask our kids better questions and invite them into a relationship as opposed to simply giving them all the answers. Finally, just to remind us, be transformed by the renewing of your mind. Like, we need to be attentive to the Spirit in us, and we need to be active participants in this faith journey. When we do that, we will move into a discipleship that is never ending. We'll be moving towards Christ-likeness. Like the song that we're about to sing, we're going to have decided to follow Jesus. And it's not an ending to our following Jesus. It's a never-ending journey of relationship with Jesus because we are following him step for step in this relationship.
We talked so long that my battery died. So you get two pastors up here and
we go
that
long.
Might happen.
My fault.
We went fast, but I hope that there was some things that really stuck with you. And Jason is going to be up here if you have questions. But we're going to sing a song together, and it really is just an anthem for that choice of I'm going to follow Jesus. I'm going to step into this journey. with Jesus. So let's stand together and we're going to sing.